Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church Podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good evening. I hope everyone is doing well this evening and having a pretty good week as we kind of settle into this new normal. We are going to be in chapter 8 this evening of the book of Daniel. And talking about the vision, Daniel's second vision of the ram and the goat, and go through that and see some of the similarities that we saw in chapter 7. There's actually a little bit of repetition and some parallel between chapter 7 and chapter 8. One interesting thing about this is that we transition from Aramaic at this point into Hebrew. Chapter 7 was actually written in Aramaic. Chapter 8 is written in Hebrew, and we knew that from the very beginning of when we started this Daniel class, that the book is written in two different languages. And so here during this point, we're looking at the Hebrew, and some would say that that is happening. First of all, it's possibly happening. There's a couple of reasons. One is that the people who are Hebrew, or only Hebrew as their language, are needing an interpretation of the Aramaic, and so it was interpreted into Hebrew at this point. Others look at it, which I like to kind of look at, is that it's a kind of a symbol of hope, that Daniel was written at this point, or at least interpreted the dream at this point, or this vision at this point in Hebrew, as a sign of hope that the oppression will soon end. Because chapter 8, much like chapter 7, dealt with the oppression of foreign countries. We're now post-exile. Most likely chapter 8 was written about the time of chapter 7. And so that was probably the time of Antiochus the IV, which would have been mid-2nd century. Now the context in which we're reading in tonight is the third year, as you can see there, is the third year of Belshazzar, who is the last Neo-Babylonian king or co-regent. He reigned along with his father, as we know that. And so it's probably most likely, at least in Daniel's life, around 551 BC. And so, but this was eventually put together in about 160, 161 BC. So just some things to think about as we think about how a document like this is put together over several years. You wonder why there's a lot of repetition. I've had questions about that in the past, about why does the Bible repeat itself? Why does it seem like it's just maybe in some cases just saying the same story over and over again? And there's many reasons for that. Sometimes it's just the style of literature of that time. You got to think a lot of this was oral before it was written down, and so stories are repeated over and over with repeated elements in the stories for people to better remember them. Also, there's also indication that what is being said will come true, or is truthful in itself, and is something that will come to pass eventually. You got to think about when you read in Genesis the story of Joseph interpreting the Pharaoh's dream of the big cows and the skinny cows and the big corn and the skinny corn. What that looks like. So a repetition there of pretty much the same outcome of having the 7 years of famine in the land. And so that's just one thing that we have to see here. What's interesting also is this, is that, and we'll see this at the end of chapter 8, Daniel is still working very actively in, this time when this was in the third year of Belshazzar, very actively in the Babylonian kingdom. I mean, he is an official, a leader. He goes about his day-to-day business, while at the same time, he's having similar sort of visions that Nebuchadnezzar had. And we can see that. We talked about that a little bit last week, about why that is true and why that looks that way. But you'll see some similarities to that part of it. Let me just pray over the scripture real quick before we get too much further along, and then we'll go. Heavenly Father, thank you for again for the book of Daniel, and thank you for just giving us the opportunity to learn the scripture, to be able to spend time in it, and to learn more about ourselves and who you are, and let us use it and apply it in a way that honors and glorifies glorifies you. In Jesus' name, amen. So as we continue here on through this, a few things we'll notice. Like I said, there are some parallels between chapter 7 and chapter 8. Both deal with visions with animals or beasts involved with it. We'll see the differences of that. Antiochus the IV shows up again, most likely in chapter 8, and he was in chapter 7 as well. One thing we will notice is that the vision is not as vibrant or terrifying as the one in chapter 7. The animals that you see here are actually what we refer to as clean animals, unlike the unclean hybrid beasts that we saw in the last chapters. So you have those differences, and they're true animals. A ram and a goat were animals that exist to this day. They're not a conglomeration of different types of animals. They are truly their own sort of mammal self. And so we'll see how that kind of ties in with this as well, especially if we're going to talk a little bit about the zodiac and how that ties in with what their beliefs were during that time. One thing about Antiochus that we have to think about is that he was not always mean to the Jewish people. He was, or oppressive, probably the better way to say, to the Jewish people. There was a time where he was a relatively, relatively decent ruler and relatively decent to the Jewish people. But it seems like at one point that he was off fighting the Egyptians, and while he was off fighting the Egyptians, the Jewish leaders, you could even say the high priest, because one of them come into this, were starting to kind of get a little restless, and were starting to stretch their power probably a little bit more than what Antiochus was comfortable with. And as any great neurotic leader, he did not like that. He became nervous, and he was worried that someone was going to try to take him out, hurt him some way, which, of course, that's what he did to several of his own either family members or close relatives or close friendships to become king in the first place. So he was one of those guys who was always a little bit nervous about what the next guy would be doing, trying to take him out, and was worried about the Jewish people. So what we know what he did then is then he started to really cause a lot of oppression over the Jewish people. A lot of traditions were removed. He put up Zeus in the temple for it to be worshipped, so he defiled the temple and caused all kinds of other problems, heartaches for the Jewish people. Pretty much for the most part, trying to make them no longer Jews, trying to make them, people after Antiochus's background and his descent. So, and that was kind of the case actually for most of the oppressive regimes. They were trying to try to make the Jews no longer Jews, no longer have them set apart, which we know through the covenant with God that Jewish people were to be set apart. So let's go ahead and get into the scripture here. We're going to, we'll start with the first four verses and go from there. And before we get through here, there's going to be a couple of new geographical landmarks that we have not talked about yet before. We'll cover some of those and just a couple of other highlights along the way. And I always think about this when we're reading books like Daniel or a lot of the Old Testament. There's a lot of symbolism involved, and there's a lot more depth to the words than just a plain text reading of them. So you have to think, really think, and be within the mindset of the Jewish people in the, most likely second century, and what they were thinking and what they were dealing with Antiochus, as well as the other tyrants that were oppressing them. So also at the same time, think of this as a book pointing to God and a book pointing to a hope in God that they will be eventually rescued. So in verse 1 of chapter 8, in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, the king of a vision appeared to me, Daniel, subsequent to the one which appeared to me previously. So another vision he has. A couple years later, I looked in the vision, and while I was looking, I was in the citadel of Susa. You guys will know where Susa is. If you've read Esther recently, that probably came to mind, and we've done that recently in Sunday school. So we'll talk a little bit more about that here in a second, which is in the province of Elam. And I looked in the vision, and I myself was beside the Ulai Canal. Susa, Elam, and the Ulai Canal, all significant and point to a few different things. Then I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, a ram which had two horns. Remember, the horns are back, kind of like last time, was standing in front of the canal. Now, the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last. I saw the ram butting westward, northward, and southward. Those are all geographical locations in which this beast attacked. And no other beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue him, rescue from his power, but he did as he pleased and magnified himself. Very few times, anytime you see magnified or some sort of variation of that, it's typically speaking to, of course, a divinity, and in many cases speaking to the Jewish God. And so the idea the author is trying to make here is that this guy was trying to be, or this animal at this point, we know it's a nation, is trying to be, is very arrogant and is trying to be like God, or is trying to be like a God. So we see that here. So he's, of course, in this very important Persian city known as Susa. Of course, that's where Esther was. It's in many Hebrew or Jewish viewpoints, it was the Persian Empire of the time, and was rebuilt by Darius the First after being destroyed by Ashurbanipal, which was a Babylonian, and pretty much turned it into, you know, the, like I said, the Persian Empire. It's an Elamite province, so we'll talk a little bit more about what Elamites, who the Elamites are here in a second. But most likely Susa was in a place where we today would know, of course, Iran, but the Khuzestan region of Iran, which is kind of just off of the Persian, just north of the Persian Gulf there. And so just to give you a little bit brief history, the Elamites were, they were actually for a short time a regional powerhouse. They were never like the Babylonians or the Assyrians. You'll read about them in most of the major prophets, the major ones, not the minor ones. And they were known to attack, they attacked the Jew, of course, Judah, the Jewish people. They attacked the Babylonians, and they eventually were destroyed by God, and eventually were actually absorbed by the Persians along the way. Elam was, of course, a descendant of Shem, who was the son of Noah, and so the oldest son of Noah, and so that kind of ties that back all the way to Noah. And they were known to be kind of an aboriginal group, and kind of traveled around the Mesopotamian area and kind of did their thing there, and eventually did settle down, became kind of a small, like I said, a small holy terror to a few people in a few regions, and eventually was crushed and absorbed by the Persians. As we continue on into here, we see the verses 2 and 3, we get the Ulai Canal, which is a waterway near Susa. Anytime you see a waterway, it could have been a canal. The way this word is used here, it could mean river, canal. Some have taken it to mean an Akkadian word, which means a city gate, where things such as judicial happenings would take place, or you know, any sort of business would take place there at the city gate. But anytime you see a waterway in something like this, it's kind of showing a visionary journey, kind of pointing out to, it's pointing to a vision. Something's about to happen, we're about to go on a journey. And so it's kind of moving us towards that by having this in kind of a water-like environment. Like I said, the word could mean many things. It could mean canal, it could mean river, it could mean waterway. Some have said they have equated it to the river Euphrates, which is in that area. You know, it's similar to what we see when Pharaoh had dreams, and of course, and there's some visions in Ezekiel as well that are all tied to a river and tied into that. So, just some things to think about here. And as you go into he lifted his eyes there in verse 3, and there's the ram with the two horns was standing there along the canal. Animals in this case are symbolizing not necessarily kings, but more like nations. This is one of the things to think about here, is what we see with these, the goat and the ram here, eventually with the the goat, is that this is just kind of typical things that nations do. They come in and they like to destroy other people for their own power, for resources, for whatever they do. And that's kind of what's happening here. So God is standing back and allowing these nations to come in and destroy other nations and to bring in their power. And it's nothing that would be out of the ordinary for a nation to do, to come in with violence and aggression to take over other nations. A few other things to think about here. We of course see the symbols of strings. Of horns, all over again. Let me turn this off. Sorry about that. See symbols of strength and power. Anytime you see horns. And we know that there's going to be a winner and a loser here, and that kind of comes out. Their first one, of course, is the ram as the first winner, and then later on we have the goat as the winner. Of course, there's symbolism tied to the length of the horns with the ram. Most likely, it's the symbolism of the Medes and the Persians. The Persians eventually the Persians being the longer horn, because they are eventually the ones that won out over the Medes. So you see that. Another thing to think about here is the use of the ram. Like I said earlier, there's some tie back to the zodiac. And the Persians like to have a god named Aries, which is, of course, known as a ram. And so that's why we see that in this vision here. And many times when a Persian king would walk into battle or march into battle, he would carry a goat's head, a golden ram's head into battle. Not a goat's head, a ram's head. And so that's just kind of a sign for the Persian people. So here come the Persians. So you can think about it this way, the Medo-Persians, or the Persian Medes, depending on what translation you're reading or what commentary you're reading, you'll see different variations of that. And as we continue on through this, let's look into verse 4. We see what the ram is doing. He's very active. So obviously he's standing there at the canal. We see the horns. We know that with the horns of one being longer than the other, the Persian horn, eventually the Persians absorb the Medes, and so the Persian horn is the longer horn, the Medes the shorter horn. That's symbolized there. But then the ram starts becoming active and was butting westward, northward, and southward. Obviously, what this is showing us, just based on the butting idea, is that it is a very powerful nation that was pretty much taking over the region at the time. It was taking over all of Asia Minor, Babylon. That was through Cyrus. And then the conquest that it went from the west to the north and to the south. And so we see all that. So we learn a little bit about the ram. This is kind of showing us the reign of the Persian Empire and the kings within the Persian Empire here. Some people say it's specific to a specific king. Others would say that the ram and the goat are about nations themselves and not to a specific king. So again, depends on what commentary you're reading. Let's continue on here into verses 5 through 8. While I was observing, here comes the goat. Behold, a male goat was coming from west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. To say that the goat was not touching the ground means it was coming with extreme speed and fierceness and was just going so fast. It's almost like one of those cartoons where someone, like the Roadrunner, right, whenever the Roadrunner is just flying down the road and didn't look like he was touching the ground. So think about it that way, just flying in with great speed, power, and aggression to eventually take out the ram. He came up to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him and struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly. So much like the ram had already magnified himself, the goat does as well. But look, there's a little bit extra here. Exceedingly. So this was even more of an arrogant, and we'll see that's what Antiochus was, even more of an arrogant nation, even more of an arrogant leadership. It's even more so, and who they thought, even more thinking they were even more divine than what they really were. But as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken. In its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. So, this takes us to, most likely, we have the Babylonians, the Persians, and then the Greeks. And so now we're with, at this point, that would be Alexander the Great, would be the one who is blowing through the entire region and taking everyone out, and eventually taking out the Medes and the Persians. And that's what we're seeing as we go through here. So as we see with what the goat is doing here, and the magnifying exceedingly, and whenever you see all these sort of this text that's tied into this, what we're looking at, like I said, most likely it's Alexander the Great. It's a nation that is coming up quickly and powerfully, and is about to take out all the powers of the known world. For those of you who are into the zodiacs, the goat is known as with the Syrians under Capricorn, and it also symbolizes the god Amuru. So just kind of give you a little bit of a viewpoint here. Also, we know just some little bit of detail here. We're not going to get too far into it with this because it just a little much for this overview of Daniel. Most likely, this could also be the Seleucids, which were also eventually became known as Syria. It could be a tie into that. So that could be some of the horns, the four conspicuous horns that came up. And when you see four winds of heaven, or four winds, that's not heaven as in heaven, heavenly realm. It's as in from the sky around the area, as in the four winds were blowing, as in this power was coming from all directions, or taking over all directions. So it wasn't just coming from one specific area coming in, it was surrounding them and coming in. So we get a little bit of view here. Like I said, most likely this is, at this point, is Alexander the Great. And eventually demolished the Persian Empire and started his empire all the way from Europe to India. So he is extremely, extremely powerful. And then why would the Greeks be able to do this to the Persians, thinking that the Persians were exceedingly strong country? And there's a whole lot of geopolitical stuff we could get into this related to why the Persians fell, but at the end of the day, the Greeks just had a stronger civilization, a stronger culture, they had more financial resources, and were just a larger and more stronger military than the Medes and the Persians, and so just overtook them out of pure brute force and ability. And that's how that played out. And so Daniel here in this vision is looking, of course, as an apocalyptic vision, is looking probably about 400 years ahead. When this is actually happening, though, is probably, like I said, about 150, 160. And so you have that tie-in of people who are now reading this during that time period, knowing what is going on from what Daniel said back in the sixth, mid-6th century. So we see that as we move forward here. Let's continue on. And depending on your translation in 9, you may have little horn, or you may have a rather small horn. And when you see that, it's not like a celebration of this horn. You got to think this author is skewed slightly towards the Jewish, not slightly, but extremely, to the Jewish viewpoint. This is a book that was supposed to get the Jewish people, allow them to be people of hope, allow them to come back in their faith to see who God is, that God would save them and rescue them. So he kind of throws in, the author kind of throws in little bits of disparaging remarks towards these who would seem to be very powerful nations, but of course, knowing that compared to God they are not. So again, just some things to look at here as we go through. Out of one of them came forth a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land. Depending on your translation, it may be Palestine, it may be something else related to that. It grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall on the earth, and trampled them down. There's some debate about exactly who that is, and we'll talk about that. And even it even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host. Who could that be? And it removed the regular sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. And on account of transgression, the host will be given over to the horn, along with the regular sacrifice, and will fling truth to the ground and perform its will and prosper. Sounds like it's going to really get ahead of itself and really take a lot of people out. Then I heard a holy one speaking. Now, that's what's interesting here is that we kind of get a view. And so this is, I believe, we're still in the vision here. And it's almost like Daniel sees all this happening. And then he steps into a conversation or kind of walks up into a conversation. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that particular one who was speaking, "How long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply? While the transgression causes horror, so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled." He said to me, "For 2300 evenings and mornings, and then the holy place will be properly restored." Now, we could spend an hour talking about what the 2300 means. We're not going to do that tonight. I'd encourage you to look that up. We will talk about it a little bit, but look that up and see. Because what you'll find is like what you see with a lot of Daniel is a lot of debate about a lot of the different areas within this, because it's so deep and there's so much symbolism to it that depending on your background, where you grew up, if you grew up in a church or not in a church, if you are familiar with Semitic historical viewpoints, if you're familiar with just ancient texts, there's a lot of different views and ways you come out of this. If you're into apocalyptic literature and you think everything points to a eschatological end time, I mean, this just really depends on how you're going to look at this, but we'll talk about that here in a second. So we start with a very disparaging remark towards the little horn or the small horn. The belief is that it grew. It's the belief is that it's Antiochus the IV, who is a Assyrian from the Seleucid line, and he is coming in and is about to really take over the world. But the way it's said here, and what's really interesting is here, is that it's a powerful horn. And so after Alexander the Great destroyed and took over this entire region, he died pretty quickly thereafter. And these other horns popped out, and there were four empires that popped out of what Alexander the Great had started. And so one of those, of course, is Antiochus, and he becomes apparently one of the more powerful ones of the group, and also the more notorious ones that are dealing with the people of the Jewish people are having to deal with. And so you see some symbolism of which way it's growing. It grows to the south and towards the east. And what that is showing most likely to Egypt and Parthia. So it went off to those parts of the world. And like I said, Antiochus was in Egypt at one point and got upset with the Jewish people and came back and started harassing them. But then you have the beautiful place, or you have the beautiful land, the beautiful one. It's most people would say it's probably Palestine is that he's referring to. Also known as the fairest land, and now it's really going to start sounding familiar. The land flowing with milk and honey. It's for the most part he's the author is pointing towards Israel, and so you are the Egyptians, the Parthians were all being attacked by this guy, as well as those in the beautiful land, Palestine, who are the Jewish people. So these are, to be able to see this is a take back to the covenant. And so if you were to turn back to Exodus 26 and the talk of the promised land or the land of promise, you'd be able to see how these two tie it together. Well, we'll see a little bit more about the beautiful land later on in chapter 11, but that's where we are with that right now. As we continue on through here, we get a lot of mythological language. We look at a lot with dealing with the host and the stars. There's about the heavenly host or those who are some of the hosts, stars. Some of the host and some of the stars to fall on the earth and trample them down. Most likely referring to celestial beings, possibly God. It could also be other pagan gods. You gotta remember, Antiochus was a polytheist, and he wasn't really just thinking just about Yahweh, the Jewish God. He was also thinking about that he's better than all the other gods too. So we have to keep that in mind. He wasn't just going after the Hebrew Yahweh. He was looking at other gods as well. So it could be that. And all, he's just really trying to take people out. Whenever you look at going into verse 11, the commander of the host. Some have said it's Michael. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if I really go with that. And this is based on a reference to the Prince of Hosts or the commander of the host. It could also be, there's other ways to look at this. It could be the high priest Onias. Onias was the, I believe it was actually Onias the III, was the high priest during this time, and he was causing a lot of grief to Antiochus. That could be a reference to that as being the high priest or being the commander of the host. It could be, if it was Michael, you'd have to go back and look at, and I encourage you to do this, go look at Joshua 5:13-15. So there's some similarity here. And as we talked about last week in chapter 7, this reference to the host or to the, for the most part, the host, the people or the beings that are up in heaven, a reference to that, you got to think of it, is it the heavenly army that this guy is referring to, that the author is referring to, or is it the people of Israel, who are the holy people, the saints of Israel, that he's speaking with as well? This is something that Gorse in Exodus 7:4, you can see a reference to that, of the people being the holy ones. Other ways to look at this, stars not even being people or beings in themselves, but actually stars in general. As in, you could think about this as just attack upon the earthly and the heavenly, of that going on, which also can make a bit of sense here. Ultimately, what I think we see, before I get into a little bit more mythology here, ultimately I think what we're seeing here is that Antiochus is attacking the way of life of the Jewish people. He is attacking the Sabbath, the festivals, the sacrifices, and all the related traditions. He's defiled the temple with the statue of Zeus and the requirement for people to worship Zeus at the altar. Again, all going back to the Maccabean revolt, that I do encourage you to read 1st and 2nd Maccabees in the Apocrypha at some point to see a lot of really good information about how that all played out. But then there's this other idea of the day star and dawn, which is kind of like, is this a song from the 60s or poetry from the 60s? And it could be that as well, because this could be a reference all the way back to the Canaanite deities that you'd see in Isaiah 14, 12-15. And where you'd see you have Halal, the day star, and then you have Shahar, the dawn, and they both try to supersede the Most High, and so you have this sort of mythological thing going on here. It's a similar situation that we saw with the arrogant king of Babylon during this time, with the Canaanite deities, that we see here with Antiochus, of trying to supersede not only all the worldly things and all the things of the earth, but everything on heaven, in heaven as well. And so you see that idea. You could even take it as further as he did not even think that he thought he was immortal. He thought that he could take out those who were mortals. And then eventually we know on his deathbed, he realized and actually said, there's no way, because it ends really, really bad for Antiochus. Really bad for him. Not good at all. But he finally realizes that there's no mortal that could ever act or ever think that they're equal to God or to gods. To a god or two gods. And so he eventually is humbled. Now, does he eventually become a Yahwist or something related to that? Probably not. We don't know. No one, it doesn't say. But he does end a very, he ends it, it ends for him in a very bad way. All right, so let's continue on here. And as we continue on into verses 10 and 11, we don't want to talk about that. Let's see here. Covered all that. All right. Let's see. Verse 12. We already talked about all that. All right. Well, we made some pretty good progress there. Skipped a lot of notes there. verses 13 and 14. And this is, like I said, when they get into the conversation between the two holy ones. Again, is it a heavenly or earthly conversation? It's hard to say here. They are obviously holy. Could it be two angels speaking together? Could be. It doesn't specifically tell us. Ultimately, there you can see they're just as, if you look at this, how it's read and worked out, they're obviously just as concerned as Daniel is. And maybe because it's his vision, they're just as concerned because he's kind of projecting that onto them. But either way, there's a lot of concern about what this horrible thing. There's obviously very uneasy about Antiochus' actions. And they want to know how long they're going to have to suffer through this. So the whole point, again, of Daniel is helping the Jewish people realize and see that the suffering is not going to be forever. But as you can imagine, when people are suffering, they want to know when it's going to end. And so they seem to be concerned, not only for themselves, but also just for the Jewish people. Which this would point, if you wanted to, you could go to Zechariah 1, 7 through 17, and that's kind of where Zechariah does his how long speech. Not speech, really, but writes about the how long idea. You got to also think this is not only about how long the people will be oppressed, but how long will the temple be defiled. Again, this is important and significant because how people connected with God was through the temple. And if they could not be in the temple and worshiping God and doing their sacrifices and going through their traditions and rituals of meeting with God, then it was very hard for them to be the people of God. And so this, of course, was a very big concern for them. It's a little bit different from us, is that we believe in the idea of a true one-to-one connection with God. But they went through a priest who would then take their sacrifices and offer them up to God. And it's so it's one of those things where if the temple was defiled or torn down or broken, it was very hard on the Jewish people. So that is also a concern as well. So the 2300 evenings and mornings, for those of you who are really good at math, probably have already realized if it's evenings and mornings, actually it's not really even true subtraction, but anyways, it stands for about 1150 days, which is pretty much a whole day of sacrifice, sacrificing twice a day, the 2300. So 1150 times 2, it gives us the 2300. And so we have that about how long it's going to happen. So for this 2300 days, or 1150 days, 2300 evenings and mornings. The period from the erection of the pagan altar, when Zeus put up the pagan altar, or when Antiochus put up the pagan altar, to when it was torn down and rededication of the temple was 3 years and 10 days. You can kind of put some of that together. So that's kind of the amount of time that there were no sacrifices offered. So as you can imagine, the people that were used to sacrifices and the people that did this very thing were not able to do that for a very significant amount of time. So, like I said, there's a lot more to the 2300 that we're not going to get into this evening, but something I wanted to bring up for you guys. So, we now go into the interpretation, which is the final half of this scripture. And it's broken down into three parts. In verses 19 through 22, we list the four kingdoms. In 23 through 25, we give a detailed and poetic view of the little horn. Again, not a compliment. And then verse 26, an explanation of the implications the vision for Daniel personally? Well, one thing I think we could all point out here is that he's already, Daniel, he has already interpreted multiple dreams, right? He's already interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dreams. He's interpreted Belshazzar's dreams. He cannot interpret his own, which I think is just interesting and just something that I just wanted to throw out there. But as we look into this, so let me read 15 through 19. When I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it, and behold, standing before me was one who looked like a man. This usage of man here is great. It's like a manly man. He is extremely manly. I don't know. If you watch Outlander, make sure you're not doing it with your kids. If you watch Outlander, it's like Jamie from Outlander. You know, that's who came to my mind of that sort of, that's like, who looked like a man. So some very strong and someone who is very, you know, manly. And I heard the voice of a man between the banks of Ulai. So we're now back to the banks along the canal, riverway, the Akkadian word, if you wanted, the city gate. And he called out and said, Gabriel, give this man an understanding of the vision. So he came near to where I was standing. And when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. And he said to me, son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the time of the end. Now those of you who like to think this is off to point to the very end, it's not. As in the end of time, eschatological side, it's not. Now, we can debate this all day long, and I'd be happy to, but the way this text is being used here, it's talking about the end of the oppression of the Jewish people by this guy. Now, while he was talking with me, I sank into a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and made me stand upright. He said, behold, I am going to let you know what will occur at the final period of the indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end. So we have this manly man, and also the way the word is used here is one who is chosen by God, is another way to look at it. And it's also a celestial reference, which we see more so there in verse 16. They're talking to Gabriel. The voice actually directs Gabriel. Some would say it would be God who is saying this. Others would say it could possibly be the other famous angel, Michael. We can see a debate, as you can see, raging around these two. But I don't really have a definitive on this one. I could see it being either way. We see here that Daniel is referred to as a son of man. Depending on your translation, maybe mortal man. As we go through that, that's a little bit further down when he gives a direction where it says, give this man an understanding of the vision. Give this man as in this mortal man, as in you're not mortal, but this man you're talking to is. And again, to separate the reason, this symbolism like this is to separate what is being said by the celestial being, be it Gabriel, from the mortal man, be it Daniel. Again, just to define the difference between the two. As we go into verse 17, we see what a lot of people do when an angel comes. If you see just other references in the Old Testament, especially earlier on, if you see references in the New Testament, people are not always super just happy, excited to see angels. Typically, they're terrified and frightened, and many times in awe, awestruck. And so that's what's happening with Daniel here, is that he is it's probably a sign of both reverence and fear, but just awe. Just think about how other people have responded in the past. In other scripture. And so while he was talking to him, he fell into a deep sleep. And some people would say it's like a coma or similar sort of trance. And the word usage here is actually similar to what happened to Adam whenever Eve was created while Adam was asleep. So when Adam fell into that deep sleep and God made Eve, this is a similar sort of words, which I just thought was interesting how that worked out here. And then, of course, which is really nice, is that the angel helps him up. You know, sometimes we look at angels as kind of hardcore kind of guys. But this angel obviously had compassion on Daniel and helped Daniel back up. So that's kind of nice to see how that worked out. And as we see the word "in" here, like I said, in verses, we saw it in 17, but I see it again here in verse 19, it's not the end of time, not the end of time as in, like I said, it's not an eschatological viewpoint. It's more of the end of this period of time, much like the end of the exile or the end of the reign of, say, Antiochus, or the end of a reign of some sort of other tyrant. And so it's not pointing as far ahead as some of us like to look. It's pointing more within, which is very typical for an apocalyptic literature like this to point closer to the time in which this was written and to the people that it's actually affecting. Another way I came across this, another way to look at end, is that, you know, they were originally in exile for a reason, right? And it was because of their disobedience towards God. They'd sinned against God. And God allowed these things to happen to them. Let's just say that. Allowed the Babylonians to come in and take them out. This end here is the end of this time, this end of this exile, the end of this one who is sinning against them, Antiochus. Is now, Antiochus went above and beyond what he was supposed to do, what God would really allow to happen. And so it's almost like he went too far. And we see other times where God has intervened, where a nation that God has been working, allowing, and kind of working his plan through has just gone too far, and he's reined it back in. Similar sort of thing that we see here. We're also seeing the end of Antiochus's wrath. He was obviously a very angry person as he was taking out the people of Israel. We see the end of God's wrath. You have to think about here is that God was using the wrath of Antiochus, which is now ending, as a way to get the people of Israel to get their attention. Kind of similar to what how Sennacherib was used by God earlier on. You know, remember Sennacherib was the Assyrian king who attacked Judah. God used that to help bring the people of Israel back to him. So, similar sort of ways to look at all that. All right. So we get a very interesting, the shaggy goat. The goat that was not shaggy is now shaggy. The shaggy goat, verse 21. Actually, I'm verse 20. I don't want to miss that. The ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. Something we've already talked about. Verse 21. The shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king. The broken horn and the four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms which will arise from his nation, although not with his power. Again, this is talking about Alexander the Great, and he's the one who's coming in. He dies after he takes over all these people and all these regions and everything. And then you have these four other horns there in verse 22 that arise from his nation, although not with his power, although not with, say, Alexander's great power. In the latter period of their rule, when the transgressors have run their course, a king will arise, insolent and skilled in intrigue. Oh, so these other kings are now weakened, and this other little horn jumps in, and he's arrogant and everything. His power will be mighty, but not by his own power, and he will destroy to an extraordinary degree and prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and the holy people. Again, the holy people here most likely are the people of Israel. Again, some people would say, well, this is more of a celestial reference of angels and the hosts, but I really believe that based on what we're seeing here is that the people of Israel, like the saints we saw in the last chapter. And through his shrewdness, he will cause deceit. Who else do we know who's shrewd? He will cause deceit to succeed by his influence, and he'll magnify himself and his heart, and he will destroy many while they are at ease. He will even oppose the prince of princesses. Who could that be? But he will be broken without human agency. The vision of the evenings and mornings, which has been told, is true. But keep the vision secret, for it pertains to many days in the future. And now, so for those of you who are really kind of into those conspiracies of the end times, that's not what it's talking about. It's talking about the end of the reign of Antiochus. But we'll get there. Then I, Daniel, was exhausted and sick for days. Then I got up again, and I carried on the king's business. But I was astounded at the vision, and there was none to explain it. So Daniel gets up. He has this horror, this crazy vision. You can imagine the amount of energy this vision took, right, to really kind of process it. But yet he goes about his day. Anyways, let's look at this a little bit. So we see that Antiochus is known to be a very bold ruler. He's also known to be ruthless, also clever. You think of him as a wicked king. He pretty much was the, if they had the Webster dictionary back then and you had the word wicked and you needed a picture next to it or an illustration, it'd be Antiochus. As it says here, he's not as powerful as what Alexander the Great was, but he's still quite the thorn in the side of the people of Israel. And one thing that we see, especially through 23 through 25, is that as this is part of God's plan, having this history of oppressive nations that were oppressing the people of Israel, the author is stating here, you kind of see through this kind of the underlying current here, that these nations are still morally accountable. And there should be expectations that God would respond to their inhumanity. And there is, and that's what happens here. As we go into verse 25, the many, the holy ones. Again, like what we're believing here is similar to the faithful community of the Jews, the Jewish people, the priests, the Jewish leaders. That's what we're talking about here. The prince of princes is referring, of course, to God. And the reason we bring that up is that earlier on we were talking about the gods, how Antiochus thought he was divine, how he thought he was immortal. He was going up not only against the pagan gods, but against God himself, thought he was more powerful than God. We don't actually see here a defeat or a definitive victory, but it is implied, or assured is probably a better way to say it, that God will be the one who takes out the oppressive king. And he does, and he will. And that's the hope of the people of Israel, that God will do that, and he will take him out. So there's that question, was there a literal fighting of angels in Antiochus? Was there a battle between the earthly Antiochus and the celestial angels of the heavenly realm? I would say, based on the context we see here, most likely not. I think this is some mythological viewpoints here. Not saying that it's a myth, but saying that it's kind of that idea of kind of bringing some symbolism and ideas into this. But ultimately, it's about attack of God's people and attack on the sanctuary. What we also see here with these references with the heavenly realm and the earthly realm is that they're connected. There's a transcendent nature and significance between heaven and earth. And Antiochus denied that. He thought he was overall powerful over everything and did not see that difference between the heavenly realm and the earthly realm. Though there's a connection between the two, he kind of forgot to see the one who keeps that all connection going, and that being God. And also that viewpoint is that when people of the earth are hurt, heaven hurts as well. And so you see that connection as we go through this. We always have to remember, and I think sometimes we forget, especially in kind of our dualistic black and white world in which we live many ways, is that we like to think of heaven and earth as disconnected and discontinuous. And in fact, they're not. There's very much a connection and continuity between heaven and earth, and we know that's going to be something that's even more so with the new heaven and the new earth. So let's continue on. Last couple verses here. The days in the future that we see here is not too far off. Again, like sometimes we like to look at apocalyptic literature as this is the end times, and end times as in end times, end times, end of the world times, not the end of a time. And what we see here is that it's not really too far off in the future when Antiochus will be destroyed. So again, a story of hope. So if this was written in the time of the mid-second century, which most likely it was, then it was not too far in the future where all this would play out and the people of Israel would be free from this oppressive rule. And the idea here is when he says, but keep the vision secret, the Daniel has this vision during the time of Belshazzar. It won't really be clear to people what it means until the time of Antiochus, because until they've experienced it and kind of started going through what Daniel's talking about here and kind of seeing how it's all played out to this point, they won't really fully understand and get the full feel of this. So, but ultimately what they'll feel from this, if this is the time period in which it was written, is that God will fulfill what he's doing and rescue his people. And as we end this tonight in verse 27, it's just interesting. When we're put in touch with the heavenly realm, every once in a while, whenever we have that, see that connection between heaven and earth, there's that idea of being awestruck, but also very troubled because in lack of better words, it's crazy. I mean, it's probably indescribable, probably a better way to say it. We don't know what the future is going to bring, and that's kind of what Daniel saw here as well, is that he knew to a point. He knew that Antiochus' rule would end, but at the same time, it's that trust in God of believing that God will allow his people to be his people and allow them to be that a people that has been set apart and the covenant people. So Daniel was looking at that, and he's looking at the future, but he doesn't know fully what the future will bring, and none of us do. And the point that we see here, and I thought was really interesting that the author did, is that, well, Daniel was troubled by this. He was awed by it. He got some answers from the interpretation. He probably did not fully understand it. Like I said, the people who lived through it probably fully understood what was going on, or at least had a better idea. But he knew that he must get up and continue to do his work. Just like we do every day, have to continue to do our work, no matter how weird it's getting out there, no matter how, I don't think oppressed is the right word, but how out of sorts we may feel right now, or inconvenienced, or saddened, or scared by what's going on, we still have to get up and do what we've been called to do and still do our work. And then that's what Daniel does here at the end of chapter 8. When he says he got up again and carried on the king's business. I mean, he didn't forget the vision. He didn't discount the vision. He didn't push it aside and say, oh, well, I'm off to this. That doesn't mean anything. He keeps it in his mind. He keeps it with him. But at the same time, he continues to do the work of God. He was doing the work of God, but also the work of the king, Belshazzar, and eventually to the Persian kings as well.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.